Welcome to Breakthrough Success. I'm your host, Mark Roberti, the content marketing expert, bringing you 5 new episodes every week where I and top-level guests teach you how to take your business to the next level and achieve your breakthrough. We have a lot of different ambitions that we're pursuing, and we are in this type of a mindset where some of us, we take the escalator in a sense where we are doing short-term stuff that gives us pleasure, but resulting in that long-term pain, that long-term not having our dreams fulfilled. And that's why when I first read the book, Take the Stairs, it was a really revolutionary idea. And I mean, I know that we hear the phrase like short-term pain, long-term gain, but this book really put that into perspective for me. So I'm really excited to talk about that book. And today's guest is actually the author of that book. So in addition to writing the New York Times best-selling book, Take the Stairs, and also Procrastinate on Purpose, he is also the co-founder of Southwestern Consulting and an internationally acclaimed keynote speaker. He is the world's leading expert on self-discipline, overcoming procrastination, and taking action to create exponential results. Today's guest for episode 176 of the Breakthrough Success Podcast is none other than Rory Vaden. Rory, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Mark. Good to meet you.
Rory, I'm really looking forward to diving into this episode. And I know you have a lot of great insights for us. But before we get started, I'm wondering if you could share with us what inspired you to write the book, Take the Stairs, and your whole mission, in a sense, in studying self-discipline, procrastination, and action taking?
Well, that's a good question. I think, Mark, I never really set out initially to write a book to solve the world's problems. It actually was started as a mission to solve some of my own problems. And this is probably back in 2004 or 2005. I was about 45 pounds heavier than I am right now. I had managed to accumulate about $50,000, 50, in debt. And the first business that I was started was, it wasn't really failing, but it wasn't scaling. And, you know, I most of these negative results in my life directly stem from one bad habit. And I don't know exactly when I developed the habit, but I know exactly what the habit was, with that at some point I reached a place subconsciously where I decided to stop doing things that I knew I should be doing, but that I didn't like doing. And I would put off things that I knew I should do, but that I didn't like doing. And, you know, in essence, the word for that is procrastination. And when I had that realization, and it was very obvious to me that that one habit was basically destroying my life, it spurred me to go, I wonder what the impact is on businesses. And we started on the dynamics associated with procrastination, the psychological causes, but also just the costs. And one of the studies that we found, there were 10,000 U.S. employees who were anonymously asked the question and given 40-hour work week, how much time do you spend on non-job-related tasks, non-job-related activities? And what they said was about 2.09 hours each day. So about a fourth of the time, which equates to, this was a U.S. study. And so we looked at the U.S. Department of Labor, the Bureau of Statistics, and we found that nationwide, the average salaried employee makes about $40,000 a year, which is about $20 an hour. And so it procrastination costs employers $10,396 per year per employee. And procrastination is the most expensive invisible cost in business today.
And you started basically looking at it from an individual standpoint, trying to fix these problems that you were experiencing. And then you look at the bigger picture and helping businesses get rid of these bad things like procrastination, some of the other habits that are holding them back. And I feel like a lot of people, we know the problems that are in front of us, but a lot of people, we tend to ignore the problems. So how are we able to approach our problems, but also our goals head on instead of ignoring them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good, that's a really good question. And there's, you know, that's kind of what the, what Take the Stairs outlines is sort of these seven misconceptions that people have about self-discipline, and helps people realize that, that self-discipline isn't as hard as we think once we know how to think about it the right way. And, you know, so we can run through any of those that you like. But I think the first thing in terms of how do we, you know, people want to know, how do I become successful? How do I break through? How do I hit my goals? But in our world, we focus more on clarifying the problem first before clarifying the solution. Too often people jump into trying to seek a solution without understanding properly what the problem is. And the problem, there's three different types of procrastination. So there's what we call classic procrastination, which is consciously delaying what we know we should be doing. That is what we typically think of when we hear the word procrastination. But we identify two other types of procrastination. One of which is creating stuff for ourselves to do so that we can do that as a means of feeling productive. In reality, it's more of a defense mechanism that we're creating things as a way of avoiding what we know really needs to be done that we don't feel like doing. That's called creative avoidance, which is the second type of procrastination. And then that one is more unconscious. It's sort of unconsciously filling the day with menial work or trivial work, busy, just being busy. And then the third type of procrastination is priority dilution. And so priority dilution is really interesting because it's different from the first two in the sense that it has nothing to do with being apathetic or lazy or disengaged, but it's the same net result as classic procrastination, which is that we end the day with our most significant priorities left incomplete because we've allowed our attention to shift to, you know, less significant but more urgent tasks. So this person, I think, you know, a classic procrastination is you're struggling with procrastination. Creative avoidance is you're struggling with distraction, and priority dilution is you're struggling with interruption. And getting clear on really which of those three are the real issue then sort of informs the ultimate strategy for how to break through.
And there are obviously different reasons for procrastinating. And one of the main themes of that is a lack of focus. And you talk a lot about and Take the Stairs about how we can increase our level of focus that we put towards our goals. And one of the things that I hear a lot about in focus is a difference between the important stuff and the urgent stuff, where the important stuff is stuff that you need to do that moves you forward, your priorities, while the urgent stuff could be like a new notification of a new email you received. So how can we stay focused on the important instead of the urgent?
Well, advance the idea to say, actually, not so much about important or something called significant, the significance calculation. And the significance calculation is different because urgency is how soon does something matter. Importance is how much does something matter. But really, the ultra performers, the multipliers, the top one percenters, they don't make decisions based on those two as much as they make a decision on significance, which is how long is this going to matter? In other words, how is this use of today going to affect tomorrow and the next day and the next day? And so procrastinate on purpose, which I wish we could go back and change the book title. The book title should have been called How to Multiply Your Time. Excuse me, because that's what, you know, like that's what the TED Talk was called, is How to Multiply Time. And it's got, you know, coming up on a million in views here. And it's really about multiplying time. And that's what everybody struggles with, is how do I know what I should spend time on and what I shouldn't? Well, you have to ultimately determine that answer for yourself. But the premise of procrastinating on purpose is the way that you multiply time is by giving yourself the emotional permission to spend time on things today that give you more time tomorrow. So you're choosing your activities based on not waking up saying, what's the most important thing I have to do today, but instead saying, okay, what are the things that I can do now that make tomorrow better? What are the things I can do today that make easier? What are the things that I can spend time on that may or may not be super important in the short term, but they create more results tomorrow? And, you know, an example of that, like a very ubiquitous example, would be online bill pay. Like, none of us have extra time in our schedule to set up online bill pay. So, you know, if you asked me, you said, okay, Rory, like, if you had 2 hours open in your day, would you use it to set up online bill pay? I'd probably say, well, no, like, that doesn't seem like an important use of my time. But when I make the significance calculation, I'm viewing it through a different lens, which is very different, is very unique in the fact that I go, okay, well, if it takes me 2 hours to set up online bill pay, but then that saves me 30 minutes a month from paying my bills, then just after 4 months' time, I will have broken even on that investment of time. And every month thereafter, I will be getting a concept, a term that we introduced called ROTI, return on time invested. In other words, I will be multiplying time because every thereafter, making time for me that I would have otherwise been spending. And automation is one of the five ways to multiply your time, which is what we, you know, talk about in that book. So, you know, question that you asked about importance is that that's not how multiplier evaluate it. They evaluate based on significance.
And another thing that you mentioned in your book is you talk about the vision, and I feel like this is a common topic, but again, the way you describe it in your book, I feel like it's different from a lot of the things that I've come across. And you mentioned like just how important that vision is.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. I'm wondering, like, we set the vision. I feel like people will read in any book, like, they'll set a vision. Like, even listening to this right now, they may set a vision for themselves, but a week from now, they may forget what that vision was. So how can we not only get more clear on our visions, but more importantly, how can we constantly bring them into focus so we continue to remember them and act based on our visions?
Yeah. You know, I think first you got to understand why have a vision, then you got to understand how to create one, and then you got to understand how do you implement it so that you don't lose track of it. In terms of why create a vision, this is related to the paradox principle of sacrifice from Take the Stairs, is that what we realize is the amount of our endurance, the amount of our self-discipline, our ability to endure pain is directly proportionate to the clarity of our vision. So if we have a crystal clear picture of what we want in life, then there is a natural connection to how the sacrifices we're asking ourselves to make today forward us towards a future that we care about. It thereby creates a context for action to take place, and our discipline engages really automatically as a byproduct. But if we don't have a clear vision, then there's as a convoluted connection to how the sacrifices that we are necessary to make to achieve that vision, they pay off. They're not connected to anything. And so what happens is, absent that vision of what the payoff is, our brain defaults to an urgency calculation of what feels safest and comfortable now. And so there is no reason to take action, and so we don't. And the human brain is not designed for success. The human brain is designed for survival. And survival is about conserving energy. So left to its own devices, the brain defaults to keeping you safe, reducing the expenditure of energy. So you need to have a clear vision to counteract that. Otherwise, there's not a way to get your brain to engage to do the right things. This doesn't mean you're lazy or you're a failure or you're not smart. It means that your body and your brain is functioning properly. But if you have the luxury of pursuing success because your basic survival survival needs are met, then you have to sort of rewire your brain, and vision is how you do that. So that's why it's important. In terms of how you create one, I mean, yeah, you know, I've been to MBA school and all this stuff and read all these books about, you know, all these things that a proper vision should have. And I think it's way overcomplicated. When you look at the lives of the people who are ultra performers, when the world's leading thinkers, the top CEOs or athletes or entertainers or whatever, a vision is simply a picture that inspires you to act. It's a picture, and it could actually be a picture that's on your desk. It could be a collage of pictures, like a vision board. That's something that, you know, we encourage clients to do. But most importantly of all, it's a picture that you can see in your mind in with visceral, excruciating detail. It's you on a stage, you know, singing a song. It's you on a beach, you know, relaxing. It's you with the family. It's like you giving the, you know, buying a house for your mom. Or it's you buying a car. It's you swimming. You know, one of mine recent ones was like swimming in my own pool in the backyard, and I like to swim. And so we built this house, you know, and that was like the big thing was picturing the pool. And I mean, my life has basically been a series of grand pictures that seemed impossible when I created the picture, but then your brain automatically reverse engineers to solve the problem of how to make it a reality. And so that's, it becomes so that's how you create one. It's just a picture. You can create it in your mind. You can, you know, draw it if you know how to draw. You can paint it. You can pull it out of a magazine, but you have that picture. And then the last part is, what do you do with it once you have it? And that's really important, is that there is a dynamic working against you. In the psychology here is something called the law of diminishing intent, which basically states that our intention to take action is highest the moment that we create that intention. But then naturally over time, that attention starts to fade. And every time, it's sort of like if you pictured a graph where the y-axis going vertically was sort of like your enthusiasm or your motivation or your discipline, and then the x-axis is time. You know, when you create the vision or you set the resolution or you set the goal, your motivation is high, but then just left to its own devices, it's going to fade down over time. So it's going to trail like in an arc downward. But every time you think about the vision, it brings it back up. It creates a spike. And then over time it fades. And then you review your vision again. It creates a spike. It makes it look more like an EKG, going up and down, rather than a decline, a steady decline. And that's kind of like, you know, not to be too cheesy with the metaphor, but that's how you stay alive. It's how you keep your vision alive, is by revisiting it. It's a simple functional process of just reviewing it. So what does that look like? Well, it means that, you know, at least for me, we did a study of common habits that millionaires have. And one of the most common is that they fall asleep at night thinking about that vision. So every night when I fall asleep, the last thing that I am thinking about is, what is that picture? What is that next picture that I am working towards? And in my mind, my life, I've always had a pretty singular focus, one at a time. And then once you accomplish it, it's sort of like you just do another one and another one and another one. And you tend to be able to build momentum and gain influence and gain resources. And so the visions can get bigger and bigger. And, you know, that... you create exponential growth as you just sort of repeat the process. But you can have that as a, you know, it can be the backdrop on your laptop or your phone. It could vision board up in your office. It can be something you visualize at night or at any point. It can be, you know, like, we're big into mastermind groups. That's what we do. Is part of our solution for this is, we know that people also left to their own device, they will falter. But if they are a part of a community of people being facilitated through a process that reinforces this consistently, that they are obviously much more likely to continue reviewing their vision. And so the results happen as a byproduct. So, you know, we offer people a free call so that they can learn about, you know, the mastermind group process, and our, you know, we have guides that I train personally on what the process is, and they, you know, they get put in a group. So, you know, people can request a free call with us and we can talk to them about that. But, you know, that a mastermind group following a process like that helps reinforce and make sure that that continues, you're continually reviewing the vision.
I really like the idea of reviewing the vision before you go to bed, because your subconscious will work on it. It stays awake even when you're sleeping. And when you wake up, you'll have that vision imprinted in your mind. So I really like that idea of looking back at the vision, and that's going to ignite a lot of action. But I'm wondering, what do you believe holds people back from taking the action they need to reach their full potential? I know the vision helps a lot, but based on your experience in yourself and seeing others, what do you believe holds them back?
Well, ultimately, fear is the number one thing that holds us back. And for a lot of people, even when I say the word fear, fear occurs to us as a very abstract concept, right? Like this emotional thing. But what I've, well, yeah, this is an old quote. This isn't a Rory Vaden original, but it's a good one. It's that fear is an acronym that stands for false evidence appearing real. And, you know, if fear, if you think of fear as this ethereal sort of amorphous, like, I don't even know if that's a word, but like this sort of abstract concept, then you don't really know how to defeat it. But once you reduce fear down to understanding what its proper definition is and understanding what it is and why it's there, then you can manipulate it and you can defeat it. So what fear is, it's your creativity working in the wrong direction. Right? When you're scared of something, you're not scared. Typically, you're not scared of the thing right in front of you. That's different. That's danger. That danger is physical. Fear is different than danger. Fear is more of a figment of our imagination. Now, fear serves a purpose in our life. In fact, a very important purpose. And when you understand that, you stop beating yourself up for being scared. You stop going, oh gosh, I just don't have what it takes because I'm scared. Fear is an essential necessity of our survival. It is part of how God created us. And this is part of how your brain works, is that, again, your brain is created for survival. The number one function of the brain, speaking from neuroscience here, is the brain's job is to keep you alive. And so it uses fear as a mechanism to keep you alive, to conserve energy, basically. Conserving energy is how we stay alive. Well, if you're approaching a big goal that is uncomfortable, your brain sort of intuitively knows you don't know how to do that. That's going to require education. It's going to require learning new things. It's going to require things that are uncomfortable and unknown. And so it uses fear to keep you safe and to conserve energy. Well, that's just your body working how it's supposed to, and your brain really working how it's supposed to. But once you understand that, you go, oh, okay, well, my creativity is just working in the wrong direction. So all you have to do is realign your creativity. You have to point your creativity in a new direction. And so the way that you do that, this is covered in the buy-in principle of commitment, and take the stairs. So this is the second of the seven strategies in the book of what you actually do, is that usually what happens is when we approach a goal, we set a goal and our immediate next thought is, oh, that's not possible, or I don't know if that's possible, or gosh, that seems unrealistic. And your brain immediately kicks into fear, creating false evidence for you about why that's not real. Well, a successful person, a multiplier, as we call them in the second book, an ultra performer, as we refer to them, Take the Stairs, what they do is instead of asking the question, is that possible? Can I do it? Is this realistic? They just intentionally choose a different question. Their question is, how could this be possible? How could I pull that off? What would it take? What to happen? What would it look like? And that is where their brain, you know, like their whole life splits and goes in one of two directions. Your brain is like a computer in that it will process on things continually until it finds a solution or until it finds a finishing point. So if you say, is that really realistic? You've already set the direction for your brain, and it's going to process on that until it finds some justification for why it's not realistic. But if you set your brain in motion along a path to say, how could that happen? How could this be possible? What would it take? Your brain goes into the autopilot in that direction, and it will run and it will process until it finds a solution to that question, which is, you know, what success is all about. It's like you figure it out, you read it in a book, or someone gives you advice, or the answer shows up. An answer always shows up. The answer, it's just that the answer that you pay attention to is the one that answers whatever question you've allowed your brain to ask. And most of us, by default, because hardwired into the very basic instincts of our survival, are looking for reasons why we can't do something versus why we can. Your mind blown, or are you mute, or did you fall asleep?
Oh no. I think you got to the very end of what you were saying, and then I wanted to make sure that you weren't still talking.
Oh yeah, no, that's funny. I was just kidding.
So one of the big things in this, I mean, the fear is, I feel like that's a very common reason for why people are not able to unlock their full potential. And I never really thought of it. That's like the body's natural response in certain situations to have that sense of survival. And I think one of the things that builds up on that fear is some of the challenges that we face along our journeys. I mean, some of us, like, our challenges are ongoing, like we may be in the middle of a big one right now. Others, they may have just conquered the hurdle, but they may be thinking about that big challenge when they approach a new challenge, and that fear comes up. So with that in mind, I'm wondering if you could share with us one big challenge you face in your journey and a powerful lesson you learned during that challenge.
Wow. I mean, there's been so many challenges. I think, one of the things that comes to mind is a time when I went all in on a goal, Mark, and I failed. But it was, and when I say all in, I went all in. When I was 22 years old, I kind of realized that, hey, I think I want to be a speaker and I want to travel the world and speak and impact people. But I was so young, I didn't feel like I had much credibility. And I heard about a contest called the World Championship of Public Speaking. And it's put on by Toastmasters International, which I was a member of for many years. And I thought, wow, maybe if I could win the World Championship of Public Speaking, that would give me some credibility that I need to kind of go out and speak, right? And so there's 25,000 contestants from 90 different countries who enter this contest. And many people, you know, there's a lot of people who will spend their entire lives, like year after year, competing, trying to win this thing. And so basically the first year I spoke 304 times for free. I took all these courses. I went to these trainings. I reviewed thousands of hours of film. I read a couple dozen books on speaking and comedy, and then I made it to the World Championship, which is the top 10 speakers in the world. And I lost, which I knew that speech really wasn't good enough to win. And I sort of ran out of time, though I was, you know, working as hard as I could. But I re-entered again the second year, and I felt, you know, much more confident. I knew what it was like to get all the way through all the levels and fully expected to get there. And so that was the year, which was 2007. And that was the year I made it back to the World Championship. And I lost again, but I lost higher. I came in second, and I was runner up in the World Championship. And a lot of people would go, oh my gosh, Rory, that sounds like a success. Well, yeah, in some ways it was a really big success. For me, it was a failure because I had a goal to win. I spent, you know, better part of 3 years throwing my life into pursuing this goal, I held nothing back. This was a early morning, you know, kind of noon and night sort of a thing. Every spare second I had going after this. And I think what I learned there ended up becoming the basis or the essence of a principle and take the stairs called the perspective principle of faith. And that one is my favorite of the seven principles in the book. And the reason it's my favorite is because all the other, you know, six of the other seven principles are all about how to achieve success, how to be, you know, how to break through, how to move forward and great progress. But the perspective principle of faith answers the question, how do the world's most successful people respond to failure? And the way that they respond to failure is very different from most people. When most people fail, we really process it internally and take it personal. We kind of say, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I won't, you know, look, I tried and I failed and I'm not meant to be successful. Well, the way that successful people process that differently is they know that there is a great payoff to going all in on a goal. And if you've done everything in your power to do something and it didn't happen, then you have, if you have faith, you believe that things are going to work out for the better. You believe that there is a greater plan and you know that you did everything in your power. But if you don't work hard, if you don't go all in, and you don't do everything in your control or power to accomplish something, and then it doesn't work out, you don't know if it's because that was the way it was meant to be, or because of a more likely truth that you just didn't show up and do the work. And so the perspective principle of faith is choosing to believe that what is happening now is for a greater glory later. It's choosing to trust that even though you don't know why something bad has happened, even though you don't know, you know, quote unquote failed, you didn't fail. I mean, the only way to really truly fail is to quit, you know, something, you know, to quit pursuing success completely. But if you went all in on something and it didn't work, what usually happens is if you fail at it, it's because it opens another door. And sometimes you have to let go of one dream in order to catch another. But you can't see the door you're really supposed to walk through. It's more like you start walking down a hallway because you see the door end of the hallway right in front of you. And so that's the one you pursue, and you think, you assume that because you can see it, that's the one you're supposed to walk through. But once you get to that door, you find out that it's locked. But then there's another door immediately to the left that you couldn't see before, and that door is unlocked. So, but if you don't do all the work of running down that hallway, then you never get there. You never see the door that was supposed to open. And so that's a choice. And faith is a choice. It's choosing to believe that what is happening now is for the greater glory later on. Again, it's almost another example of letting your creativity work in a positive direction. So for example, let's say you have a flat tire, right? If I have a flat tire today, most of us, we would say, oh, you know, damn it, I have the worst luck. I have this flat tire. It's so, you know, this is bull crap and I don't have time for it, you know, all of this stuff. Well, the way a multiplier might process that is they go, oh, I got this flat tire. Maybe it, you know, like if you have a flat tire and you think all you pay attention to is the flat tire, it's this big problem. But if you create this alternative explanation and you go, well, what if this flat tire saved me from a fatal car accident that I would have been in 10 minutes down the road? You feel completely different about the flat tire. The flat tire hasn't changed. It's still the same flat tire. But your emotions in the moment of how you respond to that flat tire are 100% determined by how you process and how you think about that event. If you think, oh my gosh, it's making me late and this is terrible and I can't believe this happened, then your emotions, you feel horrible and you know, you spin out of control. If you create that sort of positive alternative explanation, then you go, gosh, you know, I don't know why this happened, but maybe it saved me from something. And all that does is it allows you to put problems into their proper size, to reduce problems to their proper size. And the perspective principle of faith actually says our ability to have peace is directly proportionate to the term of our perspective. So, you know, if I had a flat tire, and tonight at dinner, somebody said, how was your day? You'd probably tell them about the flat tire, because the nature of the question causes you to think about what happened in that day. One day is a very short-term perspective. And so a flat tire is a pretty big event in the course of all things that can happen in that day. But let's say you were on your deathbed at the end of your life and somebody said, tell me about your life. You probably wouldn't tell them about that day you had a flat tire, because while a problem in relation to today is a big problem, most problems in relation to are a small problem. And taking that a step further, a problem in relation to eternity is no problem. So if you have an eternal perspective, then all problems are sort of reduced to their proper size. And that is a matter of choice. That's a matter, that is a mental shift. That is a freedom that you have if you can, you know, discipline your mind to respond and react in a certain way.
Rory, you shared a lot of amazing insights in that jam-packed answer. And I want to bring people's attention to the fact that you became a really successful speaker from just getting started to being one of the best in the world in just 3 years. So if you have an ambition, you're willing to go all out the way Rory did, then you can achieve your big goal within 3 years with that level of effort. And I'd like to transition to the next question, because I know we don't have a lot of time left, but we've talked a lot about take the stairs, but I'm wondering if you could share with us three books that you believe will have a positive impact on us.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you go to roryvadenblog.com, I actually, because I get this question a lot, which I love because I love to read, I wrote a couple. The answer is it depends on what you're interested in. And I published, there's a couple different articles. One was called The First 10 Books You Should Read If You're Going to Be a Leader. Then I think we did an article that was called The First 10 Books You Should Read If You're in Sales. Then I did another one that were, the first 20 books you should read if you're interested in learning about money. So I'll give you one from each of those. The best book that I have ever read on sales is a book called The Go-Giver, and it's by Bob Berg. And it is all about the idea that instead of focusing on what you can get from people, focus on what you can give to people. And by the more that you give, the more influence that you create. The next best, so that would be my number one book for sales. My number one book for money, other than the Bible, would be a book called The Total Money Makeover by Dave Ramsey. And he outlines a very detailed plan to get out of debt, which wife and I followed to a T, and it radically changed our life. And once we became debt-free, it's completely changed our life and the future trajectory of family. And then on leadership, the best book that I've ever read on leadership of Leaders Eat Last by Simon Sinek. And it is a mandatory book that we highly encourage and request that all the leaders on our team would read it, because it's really phenomenal.
Rory, thank you for sharing those great book recommendations. We'll have links to the show notes at markandbrady.com/E176. You guys can also check out roryvadenblog.com to see some of Rory's content. You can also read his book, Take the Stairs. That is a really great book. I strongly recommend that. I'm actually diving into your next book right now. And before I do wrap up this episode, I've asked you several questions at our time together, but what do you believe is one question that we need to be asking ourselves more often?
Well, I think the question people often ask me is, they say, okay, Rory, so let's say I start doing this stuff, right? Like, let's say I start, you know, watching out for procrastination and creative avoidance and priority dilution, and I'm leveraging a long-term vision, and I'm asking the question how, and I'm being disciplined, and I'm taking the stairs. How long do I have to do that for? And the truth is, we never get to stop being disciplined, because of something that we call the rent axiom. And the rent axiom says that success is never owned. Success is only rented, and the rent is due every day.
Rory, I absolutely love that final takeaway. And I mean, I'm very appreciative of you coming on the show. I mean, I've really enjoyed your book. I keep talking on and on, but I just want to say thank you for taking the time to come on the show and share your insights with Breakthrough Success listeners.
Well, you're welcome, Mark, and I'll just tell you directly, we get for a lot of podcast interviews, and the reason I came on your show is because of you and how much influence and how hard you're working to get to the world, and you don't get to have the number of followers that's like you without being focused and dedicated on serving and providing value. And that is the sole reason that I came on the show, is that I was impressed by you, especially for your age. And so you are on a trajectory, my friend, that is very, very steep and exciting. And so just continue to serve people and keep working at it, man.
Thank you, Rory.
How does over 100 retweets per day sound to you? My free ebook, 27 Ways to Get More Retweets on Twitter, has you covered. I use the methods within this ebook to get over 10,000 retweets every single quarter. To learn more and get access to this free resource, visit markgoberti.com/retweets.